And hello and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're on the web at kuci.org and we're on iTunes at College Radio. Today is Wednesday, April 11th, 2018. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and my guests today are Rachel Kong and Julia Fierro. Both of these novelists were on my panel this past weekend at Literary Orange, an annual event that takes place here, well, not right here, but nearby in Newport Beach, California, usually on the first Saturday of April. After our panel, there was more to talk about, so I'm so happy to have these authors on the show. First up is Rachel Kong. Rachel grew up in Southern California and holds degrees from Yale University and the University of Florida. From 2011 to 2016, she was managing editor, then executive editor of Lucky Peach magazine. Her fiction and nonfiction have appeared in Tin House, Joyland, American Short Fiction, The San Francisco Chronicle, The Believer, and California Sunday. She's here to talk about her novel, Goodbye Vitamin, named Best Book of the Year by NPR, the Oprah Magazine, Vogue, San Francisco Chronicle, Esquire, Huffington Post, Nylon, Entertainment Weekly, BuzzFeed, Booklist, and The Independent. And it was also nominated for this year's Los Angeles Times Book Prize, finalist for First Fiction. Welcome, Rachel.
Thank you so much for having me, Barbara.
Sure, of course.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Goodbye Vitamin and how the novel came about.
Sure. Well, so Goodbye Vitamin is, I'm still, you'd think that I would have an elevator pitch nailed down by now, but I don't quite. It's a story about a young woman who sort of at a crossroads in her life, not quite sure where she is professionally and personally, and she decides to go home to spend Christmas with her family, and while she's home, asked by her mother to stay for the year to keep an eye on her dad, who's sort of in the beginning stages of Alzheimer's disease. And so the book just chronicles that year. Not a lot happens, but it sort of puts it's about the little moments that happen between people and the things that happen, you know, just in their relationships throughout the year.
Well, it's interesting what you just said about elevator pitches and mm-hmm. how to sum things up. And I'm curious if at any point you or your agent or your editor really, really wanted you to be able to sum it up. I mean, was that ever a concern?
Yeah, well, you know, that's what I think back cover blurbs are for, and that's your book is getting summed up all the time for you. I think that they weren't, they had sort of no control over what I was going to say about my own book, but you know, they have their versions and their elevator pitches, and I sort of at different points in time, I feel like the book means different things to me too.
Yeah, I loved it, and I, well, for various reasons, but one of the things I really appreciated was, and what we talked about on the panel a little bit on Saturday, was the voice that you lassoed for this book. And I don't know if maybe you could talk about whether that is your writing voice or if that voice occurred and kind of took birth for this particular book.
Yeah, well, I think it's a little bit of both. You know, this book was maybe a very exaggerated version of a voice that I am now sort of writing in for various stories and things. I think that it was also a voice that came about for this book. Like I mentioned on the panel, I mean, it came out of this short story that I was really just experimenting with. It was a really, really short story in which I wrote from the first person point of view and really had a lot of fun with it. It was the first time I had ever really allowed myself to do that. It felt more casual, and I had always wanted to write something really serious in capital letters, you know? But when I tried it, it was so fun and so liberating. And I think that that was really the moment that it clicked for me. And it felt like I found the perfect voice, especially for this book, but also it was just like unlocking another way of writing that was really exciting to me.
Well, what you just said in terms of writing a book, you know, an important book or a big book, you know, it's interesting because the voice is light and yet you're writing about some serious stuff here. You know, Ruth's father is losing his memory, and this is momentous because he is a professor. And so I found sort of the voice that was sort of a counterpoint, the voice and the theme of the book.
Yeah, I really wanted to do that. That was really important to me because I feel like that's how life is, and I really wanted to write about real feeling people, about real things. And I think that day to day, moment to moment, we're always feeling so many things at once, right? Like even if you're going through something really difficult or really sad, there are moments of levity. There are people who crack jokes. You know, it's rarely, I mean, I won't say it's always, but it's rarely, you know, all one type of feeling or emotion. And so I really wanted to capture that and to show just the humanity and, like, you know, feeling sad, feeling happy, being able to crack a joke all at once.
Yeah. I'd love to hear you read from Goodbye Vitamin. Would you do that?
Yeah, sure. This is pretty near the beginning. Christmas morning, Dad pulled out a small, worn red notebook. He explained he's kept it since I was very little. Inside, there are letters to me. He'd been waiting for the proper time to share them, but it had slipped his mind, wouldn't you know, until now. He showed me a page from this notebook. Today, you asked me where metal comes from. You asked me what flavor are germs. You were distressed because your pair of gloves had gone missing. When I asked you for a description, you said, they are sort of shaped like my hands. Then he closed the notebook very suddenly and said, as though angry, that's enough. December 29th. Now Mom is asking if I could stay a while to keep an extra eye on things. By things, she means Dad, whose mind is not what it used to be. It comes as a surprise. Things aren't so bad. Dad doesn't seem any different, on top of which my mother hates to ask for anything. Just the year, Mom repeats, when I can't manage to answer. Think about it. On the way to the bathroom, I catch my mother shouting, no, 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 you're expensive, to a vitamin she's dropped. Ginkgo, I think. The first thing started approximately last year. Dad forgetting his wallet, forgetting faces, forgetting to turn the faucet off. Then it was bumping into things and feeling tired, even after full nights of sleep. That he'd been a drinker, Dr. Lung said, didn't help. There is presently no single test or scan that can diagnose dementia with complete accuracy. It's only after the person is dead that you can cut his or her brain open and look for telltale plaques and tangles. For now, it's a process of elimination. What we have are tests that rule out other possible causes of memory loss. In diagnosing Alzheimer's, doctors can only tell you everything that it isn't. What my father doesn't have: hyperthyroidism, a kidney or liver disorder, an infection, a nutritional deficiency. Deficiencies of vitamin B12 and folic acid can cause memory loss and are treatable. I'm just straight up demented, Dad says. I'll stop there.
Oh, that's lovely. Thank you. That was Rachel Kong reading from Goodbye Vitamin, published by Henry Holt. Wanted to ask you, in what you read, two things. One is that the sections are preceded by a date, as if you know, as if you're writing a journal, as if the author or the narrator actually is writing a journal. Mm-hmm. And the other is that the father character, right throughout the book, there are letters that she has found that he has written to her, starting when she was, you know, very young. Talk about those two things and how those came into play, the dates and the letters.
Sure. Well, you know, I didn't know, I had never written a novel before. I did not know how to write a novel. I'd always written short stories. And so for me, writing in these pieces and writing in these smaller paragraphs and sometimes just fragments were a way to ease myself into thinking of this as something larger. I just, you know, kind of put one paragraph after the next and then it grew and grew. So that was really more for me than anything else, just like a way to approach writing a novel, because it seemed so daunting. It just seemed like something that was impossible, the way that, like, you know, when I was little, I never thought that I could buy a car or a house. They just seemed so big, right? And so it was more for that in the beginning, you know, than anything else. It was just a very practical sort of, like, tricking myself into being able to write. But as I was writing, I realized how perfect it was for what I was trying to do. I'm really interested in memory and sort of what we commit to memory. And so both the, you know, those little diary type entries and the father's notebook, both of those, I think, are really interested in the question of, you know, what do we write down and what do we choose to remember? You know, often you can't really decide what you do remember, but I think that writing things down is a way to try to work against that. And it's also like an exercise in control, right? Like it's a way to feel like you have some control over the things in your life that maybe aren't in your control. And so I was really interested in, you know, just like personal narratives, what we decide to commit to paper and what we decide is important in our own lives. And then, you know, apart from that, what we really don't choose to remember that kind of haunts us anyway.
What about the point of view and the tense, first person present? Was it always mm-hmm. that?
You know, it wasn't always that. It really shifted around a lot. I remember I had a teacher in grad school, the writer David Levitt, and he always said that first person present tense he hated everything that was ever written in first person present tense. And I had that voice in my head in the beginning, and I was like, oh, I have to set it in past tense, I can't do present because David hates it. But it, in the end, it had to be this way. And I think it's because it is a book about moments and, you know, living in the present. I think that as a person, I've often you know, been overly attached to the past or overly worried about the future. And I'm a person who, like, sometimes has trouble just existing in the present and, like, being fully here. And so I think that the tense was important for this book because, you know, for Ruth, she's like kind of haunted by her past, and the future isn't really something that she can look forward to, right? Like, her father is only getting worse. This is not a disease that ever turns around. And so it's sort of not really in her interest to think about, like, what's next for herself. And so the present tense was really a way to just sort of zoom in on the really, you know, particular moments that happen day to day.
I can't imagine it being in any other point of view or tense. And I always think about something, Lisa Cron, who has written a couple of books on writing and has been on the show a couple of times, what she has said, which is that she thinks that, and I don't know, maybe it's from her screenwriting background, perhaps, but she thinks that books should be written in the first person. And hopefully present tense, unless you're doing a multiple point of view novel, in which case then you would do third person. Otherwise, if you're not doing multiple point of view, it has to mm-hmm. be first person. That's the most interesting. I think that's really, you know, I never really quite heard anybody say that. And I kind of agree.
Yeah, I love that. That sounds great. I mean, I feel like, to me, you know, a book is so much about getting into somebody else's head and, like, trying to get as like granular as I can, right? I just really want to know how are other people thinking, and like, what is it? We're all so different, like in terms of like physical bodies, but also our minds are like, you know, there's a lot there, and it's hard to really know a person just through conversation. And so when I read a book, I really want to know everything. And first person seems like the best way sometimes to get there.
I guess part of the reason why, well, maybe why writers don't write in the first person is because they don't want to be confused with the narrator, with the protagonist mm-hmm. of the book. Was that ever a worry of yours that people are going to say, oh, this is really, you know, thinly disguised memoir?
Yeah, that was like 100% the main worry, and why I never wanted to write in the first person was because I felt like, you know, I have always wanted to write fiction, and that's been like the great love of my life. And I have never, ever been even vaguely tempted by like memoir writing. I just feel like I want to imagine things and not adhere to any kind of truth. And so I was always, yeah, really terrified of writing in the first person for that reason. But, you know, I've sort of come to terms with it lately. And even when people kind of conflate me with the narrator, it's annoying, but at the same time, I feel like I'm going to hopefully be writing lots more books, and hopefully in the future that won't happen as much, right? Like, how could they confuse me with every single person in every single book? So that's like my attitude at the moment. But you know, I think that like my general comment to these the people who are making these assumptions is that, you know, fiction is fiction, and there are definitely truths in the book that I'm really interested in, just questions in the book that I'm really interested in answering. And, you know, a lot of the emotions in the book are real emotions that I have felt. And so I'm not only the main character, I am, like, elements of all these other characters. The main character happens to, like, look the most like me, but I'm also like the father. I'm also like the mother and the brother, and all of the obsessions and concerns that I have found their way into this book. Of course, you know, it's like something that I've been working on for years, and that has really been just a place for me to delve into questions that I have about being a person.
Curious about, you know, you just said you were working on it for a long time. Can you talk a little bit about going from the first draft to the final draft, and how much it either stayed the same or how much it changed? What was that like?
A lot changed and a lot stayed the same. I actually have always had that first image. The first thing that happens in the book is, you know, a man sees the father's pants hanging from a tree that still has Christmas lights in it.
Yeah, I love that.
And I always had that image right from the very beginning. And so that's where the book always started, was the day after, or it was just, you know, right around Christmas time. And then I've always had the ending to just that image of the family all together and not completely healed, but, you know, on their way to having better relationships with one another. And it was really all the stuff in the middle that I revised and revised over and over again. And because the book doesn't have much in the way of plot or things that happen, I was never really writing towards specific goals in terms of action. Like, I was always really just writing, rereading, and rereading to try to figure out, like, if I had struck the right balances between, you know, humor and grief, and between, like, just sort of all these things that I was trying to balance, and often just, like, having to, like, you know, put things away and try to trick myself into thinking that I hadn't read this book, you know, thousands of times.
Were there surprises in writing it? Were, did anything come out of it, or did something change in the story or in the structure? Did anything kind of jump out at you and go, wow, okay?
Well, the first surprise was that I could do it, like actually write a book. That was a really satisfying thing. I think that, you know, I think writers and all of us probably have a lot of self-doubt and think, you know, what, who am I? What can I really do? And so that was really exciting to me to just be able to finish it. And then for it to be in the world is really exciting. But I mean, a really nitty gritty thing is that I think, I don't remember how this happened, but very magically, that change sort of 2/3 of the way through from first person to second person, where Ruth, the daughter, is now keeping sort of record for her father. I think that was just, it came to me sort of suddenly, just trying out that voice and that switch to second person. And to me, that really is what made the book click for me.
Mm, interesting. We are almost at the end of our time with Rachel Kong, author of Goodbye Vitamin. So stay with us. And if you just tuned in, this show will be podcast along with hundreds of others on penonfire.com. So I love the title Goodbye Vitamin, and it encapsulates kind of the whole feeling of the book, the bittersweet quality, the light voice, just a lot of different things that are going on with the story. Talk about the title, and was that always the title?
Yeah, the title, you know, I felt like I wanted a title that no book had ever had. So I just wanted something weird. I also, like you said, wanted to capture the fact that, you know, people in the book are talking to inanimate objects and sort of slowly losing it. But it actually used to be Hello Vitamin, and that was what it was for a long time. And at some point I decided that was too happy. So I changed it, but I don't really have a good, you know, some people love the title. Some people are really puzzled by it, which, you know, maybe is fine. In Germany, it's actually, instead of Goodbye Vitamin, which they've decided does not roll off the tongue in Germany, in German, they're going to call it The Year Dad Ironed a Steak, which is okay. Very, yeah, feels very German.
That's interesting. Now, you know, I noticed this book months and months ago, and part of it was the title. I just found it really intriguing, and you know, it felt happy and bittersweet. You know, it felt everything that it is, and yeah, I think it's great.
Well, I'm glad. Yeah, it's too late to change it.
We're at the end of our time, and I wonder if there have been any novels or writers that have influenced you.
Oh, yeah. Well, so many. You know, I think that I really realized that books could be, again, back to that question of, like, what is serious and what is not. I think I realized that books could be short and have a huge impact. They could be about women's domestic lives and still, you know, be really, really important books. And so those books to me are things like Joan Didion's Play It As It Lays, or there's a book that I love called The Pharmacist's Mate by Amy Fusselman. Mm-hmm. Of course, Love Anything by Maggie Nelson. There's so many books that are just short, poetic, and beautiful. And I think that when I was introduced to those and realized that these were as much novels as those huge door stoppers, that really changed everything for me.
Mm, interesting. Rachel, it's been a great pleasure to talk with you again. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
You're welcome. That was Rachel Kong. Her new novel, her debut novel, which I mentioned is nominated for an LA Times Book Prize this year, this month, in a couple of weeks, next Friday night, we'll find out, and I sure hope it wins. Goodbye Vitamin, wonderful read. I recommend it highly. Everybody needs to read this book, right? Anyway, stay with us. We'll be back with Julia Fierro. Don't go anywhere. Ooh.
been such a long, long time. Look like I get you off of my mind, but I can't. Just a thought of you turns my whole world misty blue. Oh, honey, just the mention of your name turns the flicker to a flame. Listen to me, good baby, I think of the things we used to do, and my whole world turns misty blue. Oh, baby, I should forget you. Heaven knows I've tried. Such a long, long time. Looks like I'd get you off of my mind, but I can't. Just a thought of you,
just a thought,
my love, my whole world turns misty blue.
Welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. And that was Dorothy Moore singing Misty Blue. My next guest is Julia Fierro. Her work has been published in Poets and Writers, BuzzFeed, Glamour, The Millions, Flavor Wire, and other publications. And she has been profiled in Brooklyn Magazine, The L Magazine, The Observer, and The Economist. She's a graduate of the Iowa Writers Workshop and founded the Sackett Street Writers Workshop. And she's here today to talk about her second novel, The Gypsy Moth Summer. And as I said right before Rachel Kung came on, Julia and Rachel were both on my panel at Literary Orange this past Saturday. And after the panel, there was a whole lot more to talk about. So I'm happy to have her on. Hey, Julia.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
Of course.
We had so much fun on at the festival, and I felt like we could have gone on for a long time.
That was fun. That was really a fun panel. but let's start by talking about the Gypsy Moth Summer, and tell our listeners how the book came about.
Well, it was actually a book that I had thought about writing for a long time. And I'm sure, as you know, because you've talked to so many amazing writers, many of whom are my literary buddies. I was looking at the list of writers you talked to, and like, it's just really an amazing group. But I'm sure you know that, like, every book, it's almost like parenting a child. You know, you're a different parent for every child. it's the same with books. Your process changes. And so for my first book, Cutting Teeth, I sat down not really knowing exactly where the story was going to end up. And that was one kind of process. For the Gypsy Moth Summer, I had had this idea, this story, and this sense of place in my head for over a decade. And a lot of the book is based on, you know, some autobiographical stories. I grew up on Long Island in the summer of 1992. I was 16, just like one of the main characters, Maddie, in the Gypsy Moth Summer. And so I knew I wanted to set a book in a time before we had the internet, because there's many storylines in the book about miscommunication, and especially with the teenagers, you know, not able to get information reliably, even though I wouldn't call the internet reliable. But I just remember, like, you know, being a teenager and, you know, having to bike to the library to look something up, because that was the only way that I was going to sort of get an answer. So what happened was, when I first went to college, I hadn't ever thought about writing as, you know, a sort of a profession that one could have. My parents wanted me to be a lawyer. They wanted my brother to be a doctor. My father is an immigrant from southern Italy, and it's a very typical sort of, you know, wish for your children, your first generation children. But I had always loved books, and in one of my literature classes, we were given a writing exercise, and I wrote a sketch of the character of the Colonel, one of the main characters in the Gypsy Moth Summer, and it stuck with me. And over the next 10, 15 years, I would pull out whatever, you know, a bunch of pages from this book that would eventually become the Gypsy Moth Summer, and I would rewrite it. And I realized that I was rewriting the first chapter. So I rewrote the first chapter of the book probably about 8 times from different points of view, from the Colonel, from Dom, the teenage boy, even once from the perspective of the caterpillars, because there's a plague of gypsy moth caterpillars that has, you know, descended on this island in the summer of 92, and which I'm a little embarrassed to admit that I wrote from the perspective of the caterpillars. But I feel like it's sort of a hopeful, you know, story of the process of how this book came about, because often, you know, as writers or any creators, often we put things aside and think, oh, I'm never coming back to that, you know, burn that book, you know, forget those pages. And I think I just needed some time to think about the story and really let it develop. I needed to grow up and be able to handle the material. So by the time I was ready to write the book, I'd been thinking about these characters and Avalon Island and the atmosphere and especially the plot of the book for many years, for over 10 years. And so it was an amazing feeling to sit down and be able to just fall into the world, you know, so seamlessly, because I'd already informed myself of so much. It was a really unique kind of writing experience that I don't know if I'll ever have again, hopefully.
Well, I'm curious if, because you wrote from the point of view of different characters and the caterpillar, if when you finally decided you were going to write the novel, is that what contributed to you deciding to make it a multiple point of view novel?
Well, actually, I feel most comfortable writing in the multiple perspective. So, which is unusual, because a lot of, you know, often when I'm interviewed, people ask, how do you keep all those plates spinning in the air, all those different perspectives? And for me, it must be natural to the way in which I interpret the world in everyday life. I'm really interested in, this sort of sad but undeniable, fact that we can't really know what other people are thinking, especially of us, right? Even those who are closest to you. And so I wanted to show, a bunch of characters who are all in the same place, this tiny island with only one exit, same time, experiencing the same events, sorry, but in completely different ways and interpreting those events very differently. And so it's sort of that kind of structure, the multi-point of view structure, where the characters' different interpretations are sort of laid on top of each other, creates a complex meaning. It's almost like the structure does the work for you. But when I first started working on the Gypsy Moth Summer in earnest, I started out writing the perspective through just 16-year-old Maddie's point of view. Mm-hmm. And so I wrote the first 80 pages just through her perspective, first person, with a retrospective tone, looking back on that summer. And my editor and I very quickly realized that would have been it would have been a different experience for readers, more of a coming of age story. And so I immediately realized that I should, shift to the third person point of view. And that was probably the most challenging part of writing the book, was taking those first 80 pages and trying to salvage, some of it, and then rewriting. It's very hard to shift point of view. You can't just cut and paste. You really have to, I ended up retyping word for word those 80 pages, because when you're shifting point of view, the tone is very different. So once it was absolutely the right decision. The book that I'm working on, or hope to be working on soon, once I I run the Sackett Street Writers Workshop, so I'm busy working, work, I call it. But I'm hoping that in the next month I'll be able to start really, focusing on this book that I've been wanting to write for a long time, which is a first-person retrospective novel set in southern Italy. So I feel like I'm ready to start writing my father's story of growing up in southern Italy during the liberation of southern Italy by the Allied forces.
Interesting. Well, I'd love to hear you read from The Gypsy Moth Summer.
Okay, so this is from the prologue, which is my favorite section to read. Is one of the first things I wrote in omniscient point of view. And, I think we talked about this a little bit on the panel at Literary Orange. That's, so much of writing, and I think being able to continue writing and enjoy it is surprising yourself. And I think that when I wrote this prologue, I was like, hey, you just wrote an omniscient point of view. So I'll read it. Before that summer of 92, when the gypsy moths swarmed Avalon Island and Leslie Day Marshall, golden-headed prodigal daughter, returned with her black husband and brown children to claim her seat as First Lady, the island's crimes were minor. Before that summer of 92, people left their front doors unlocked when they turned in for the night, and children, even those who still believed in the witches and wolves of fairy tales, fled to the woods each evening. Be careful, their mothers called, as the children threw open screen doors and ran bare-legged into the birch turned blue by the otherworldly light that blanketed the island each night. On an island, time can freeze, but that summer the islanders felt a change coming. East and West agreed. There was a yawning divide between old and young, yesterday and tomorrow. The new generation of Avalonians worshipped at the altar of MTV, didn't fear the bomb, heard the slogan, be all you can be, and thought not of defending his or her country, but instead imagined their future selves waiting to hatch like the moth eggs tucked in the crooks and bends of every tree on the island. But for now, it is June, and the roses are in bloom. The tough and thorny rugosa's apple-shaped hips thrive on the island's dunes, the bright pink swamp rose in the marsh. High in the East Hills, the air is heady from the ladies' gardens, rows of hybrids whose names conjure Victorian women in high-collared and bustled dresses, strolling arm in arm under a parasol. Lorraine, Lita, Bourbon, Starlight, Ballerina, and the aromatic American Beauty. Each bloom impeccable, a perfection that confirms the East Islanders' belief that all can be cultivated, controlled. Their children and spouses and lovers and servants, their workers and factory, their island and country. By summer's end, all of Avalon will have seen too much to play make-believe at love and war again. So let them believe for now. Let them play. Those girls with dimpled smiles and scraped knees, those young men lean and long but still capable of blushing. Those unformed and perhaps better versions of the men and women they will become.
So. Thank you so much. That was Julia Fierro reading from The Gypsy Moth Summer. You know, I wanted to talk about something that we talked about on Saturday a little bit. Maybe we can talk a little bit more about it, go into a little more depth. And that is writing honestly. And it, you know, When you talk about this amongst fiction writers, especially new writers, you often get a lot of kind of confused, befuddled looks, you know, like, well, but it's fiction. What do you mean, you know, I need to write honestly? What does that mean? But writing fiction, it's important to write honestly, write the characters the character should be and not, you know, who, you know, we don't want to be judged for writing, you know, this character who does whatever it is. Can you talk about that?
Sure. I think it's a really important question. I was very excited that you brought that up. It's a question that makes writers think, you know, really think about their process. And I think so much of writing, you know, the most fascinating part of writing for me, and what I love talking about, and it's also why I love teaching and running the Sacca Street Writers Workshop, is talking about really the psychological process of writing, and especially in novel writing, like the various ways in which we trick ourselves into believing a lot of things that, you know, if you really analyze them, you're like, that's pretty delusional. That, you know, these characters are not real, you know, are real for the writer, and then eventually if you've done a good job, for the reader. So for me, writing honestly it's a little bit more simple. I don't have a lot of self-control in general, you know, like I'm a very honest person in many ways. I am emotive and, you know, just talk too much and, you know, share too much. I'm an oversharer. So I do think that for me, writing is probably, I would say, the place where I'm the most honest. And it's not a choice. You know, I write to escape, which is why I've always read. And I think for a lot of writers, it's a similar experience, you know. And part of that is because, you know, the fictional worlds that we create, no matter how dark and dramatic and, you know, scary and suspenseful, are safer than, you know, real life. It's a place. I think novelists especially are often control freaks. I am. And, you know, your fictional world is where you can
in some ways control what happens. Of course, there's those moments of amazing surprise. And I think that's probably the most honest place that you can go, you know, where you're so, you've allowed yourself to let go of that control, right, which is a major factor in writing a novel. You really have to control a lot. Structurally, so many characters, you know, it's a lot of words. So I do think that it's those moments where you let go of that control and that, you know, I guess we could call it honesty takes over. And in those moments is, you know, I think that's when the characters reveal themselves to you in a certain way. So for me, you know, when I wrote Cutting Teeth, which is a very, you know, dark comedy about urban parenting, you know, in the sort of contemporary, you know, setting. So like the over-informed parents who want to be perfect and do everything, you know, a certain class of parents. I wrote that book not really believing it would be published. I hoped it would be published. So for me, writing that book was as honest as I'll ever be. You know, I just wrote it to finish a book. There were, you know, I was trying to make sense of my own experience as a new parent. And I remember when I had my first lunch with my editor and she said, "Is there anything that you're worried about?" Which is funny because I'm very neurotic and I worry a lot. And I said, "No." And then I went home that day and I realized that this very private book, you know, that you write completely alone. Sometimes you don't even have that many readers. And writing is such a private act is going to be, you know, this book will now be public. And I remember thinking like, oh God, people are going to see what a bad, you know, what a sort of inadequate mom I think I am, you know, because that's really for me, like the hardest job, the one that you want to do the best, you know, at. And I think that it will always be a challenge for me. I'm always going to be extremely honest in my writing. And then in real life, I'm, you know, it's something that I'll have to sort of struggle with a little is that, wow, you just put yourself out there, even though it's fiction, you know, it's very much, you know, I really feel that every novel really is the writer in many ways. Even if the characters don't look like us, are set in a different period, you know, are from a different, you know, have a different perspective. So for me, the honesty was especially important in the Gypsy Moth Summer because I was writing a book in which, like, you know, bad things happen to good, you know, people who aren't good or bad, but just make bad choices like we all do. And I was also writing through, you know, several perspectives that are completely unlike my own. Dom, the young boy who's realizing that he's gay while he's living on this very conservative island. Jules, who's a middle-aged African-American man. So I think, you know, going into the book, constantly thinking like, you know, I owe it to these characters, you know, to really, really try to be as honest as possible, you know, true to their perspective and their experience, you know, and be aware of the fact that I'm writing from my, you know, that my own perspective as a, you know, quite privileged, you know, white woman is very different. So I think that the topic of honesty is important in many different ways. Emotional honesty, you know, doing the work when you're writing through a different perspective, so that you really are using as much empathy as possible. And I think readers will feel it if there's not honesty in the book, you know. I think that their emotional experience will be, you know, different.
Yeah, and I know one worry is no matter what perspective you're writing in, that that you, the writer, will be judged, that your readers will think this is you, even if it truly isn't, right? And so we kind of adjust characters because, you know, we don't want anybody to think it's us.
Yeah, I sort of have let go of that because I feel like, I mean, I know I have a lot of, you know, most of my friends are writers. My husband's also, you know, writing novels. And so, I talk about, you know, these really fascinating topics a lot, you know, on a daily basis. Oh, my gosh, I'm so lucky. And I think that for me, you know, I see people fight that sort of like, oh, it's not me. And I understand, you know, that impulse. But I feel like, you know, I just admit that a lot of the characters in the books, even the ones that don't look like me or come from the same background, are me in certain ways. So, you know, obviously Maddie, you know, she's 16 in 1992. I was 16 in 1992. So I start from a very autobiographical place. And then I let the sort of fiction take over. So even if I try to sort of keep to like a very autobiographical, it just goes somewhere else. Mm-hmm. So I would say that many of my characters are me and not me at the same time. But I do think it's important for writers to acknowledge that it's more complicated than it's not me or it is me, you know, that
right.
It's pieces of us, because I don't know, I see writers sort of feeling like ashamed of the fact that maybe they're writing, you know, about themselves through the fictional filter.
Mm-hmm.
But of course we are. I mean, this is how we make sense of who we are.
Yes.
In the world and our place in the world. You know, we wouldn't be writing if we weren't trying to figure out some part of ourself. You know, I write to inform myself of myself and how I feel about the world and humanity and my place in it and other people's place in sort of the larger story of humanity. So,
yeah.
But I do think that with the rise of, you know, with the internet and like readers, you know, having access to authors on social media, Goodreads, Amazon, that I think there is an expectation that's relatively new that you know, readers will have a connection with the authors that they're reading, which is really amazing. I mean, there's nothing more amazing than having readers. It's just incredible. It's an incredible privilege. But I do think that that may sort of increase this idea that, like, the writer is the character,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm. Oh, Julia, we could use another hour or two or three to talk. And sadly, we're at the end of our time. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed talking to you.
It's been great talking. And maybe when your next book comes out, we can talk again.
Yes, I need to finish it.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
That was Julia Fierro. Her novel is The Gypsy Moth Summer. That's all we have for you today. If you want to know more about the show or literary events in the area, visit penonfire.com. Until next time, I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and thank you for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine.